His face suddenly grew wise. It grew wise so suddenly that it was frightening to watch. It was wise and helpless and enduring. It was a face I recognized from the news when I was only 8 or 9 or so. The face of all those soldiers in black pajamas who had kicked the living shit out of the best equipped and best supported army in the world. "Dennis," he said. "I'll do what I can." Chapter 10. LeBay Passes. The movie version of Grease had just opened, and I took the cheerleader out to see it that night. I thought it was dumb. The cheerleader loved it. I sat there watching those totally unreal teenagers dance and sing. If I want realistic teenagers, well, more or less, I'll catch the Blackboard Jungle sometime on a revival. And my mind just drifted away. And suddenly, I had a brainstorm, the way you sometimes will when you're not thinking about anything in particular. I excused myself and went into the lobby to use the payphone. I called Arnie's house, dialing quick and sure. I'd had his number memorized since I was 8 or so. I could have waited until the movie was over, but it just seemed like such a damned good idea. Arnie himself answered. "Hello? Arnie, it's Dennis."
"Oh, Dennis."
His voice was so odd and flat that I got a little scared. "Arnie, are you all right?"
Sure. I thought you were taking Roseanne to the movies."
"That's where I'm calling from."
"It must not be that exciting," Arnie said.
His voice was still flat, flat and dreary. "Roseanne thinks it's great." I thought that would get a laugh out of him, but there was only a patient, waiting silence. "Listen," I said, "I thought of the answer."
"Answer?"
"Sure," I said. "LeBay. LeBay is the answer."
"Le,"
he said, in a strange, high voice. And then there was more silence. I was starting to get more than a little scared. I'd never known him to be quite this way. "Sure," I babbled. "LeBay. LeBay's got a garage, and I got the idea that he'd eat a dead rat sandwich if the profit margin looked high enough. If you were to approach him on the basis of, say, 16 or 17 bucks a week..."
"Very funny, Dennis."
His voice was cold and hateful. "Arnie, what?" He hung up. I stood there, looking at the phone, wondering what the hell it was about. Some new move from his parents? Or had he maybe gone back to Darnell's and found some new damage to his car, or... A sudden intuition, almost a certainty, struck me. I put the telephone back in its cradle and walked over to the concession stand and asked if they had today's paper. The candy and popcorn girl finally fished it out and then stood there snapping her gum while I thumbed the back where they print the obituaries. I guess she wanted to make sure I wasn't going to perform some weird perversion on it, or maybe eat it. There was nothing at all, or so I thought at first. Then I turned the page and saw the headline. "Libertyville Veteran Dies at 71. There was a picture of Roland D. LeBay in his army uniform, looking 20 years younger and considerably more bright-eyed than he had on the occasions Arnie and I had seen him. The obit was brief. LeBay had died suddenly on Saturday afternoon. He was survived by a brother, George, and a sister, Marcia. Funeral services were scheduled for Tuesday at 2. Suddenly. In the obits, it's always after a long illness, after a short illness, or suddenly. Suddenly can mean anything from a brain embolism to electrocuting yourself in the bathtub. I remembered something I had done to Ellie when she was hardly more than a baby, 3 maybe. I scared the bejesus out of her with a jack-in-the-box. There was the little handle going around and Big Brother Dennis's hand, making music, not bad, kind of fun. And then, kabonzo! Out comes this guy with a grinning face and an ugly hooked nose, almost hitting her in the eye. Ellie went off bawling to find her mother, and I sat there, looking glumly at Jack as he nodded back and forth, knowing I was probably going to get hollered at, knowing that I probably deserved to get hollered at. I had known it was going to scare her, coming out of the music like that, all at once, with an ugly bang, coming out so suddenly. I gave the paper back and stood there, looking blankly at the posters advertising "Next Attraction" and "Coming Soon." Saturday afternoon. Suddenly. Funny how things sometimes worked out. My brainstorm had been that maybe Arnie could take Christine back where she had come from. Maybe he could pay LeBay for space. Now it turned out that LeBay was dead. He had died, as a matter of fact, on the same day that Arnie had gotten into it with Buddy Repperton, the same day Buddy had smashed Christine's headlight. All at once, I had an irrational picture of Buddy Repperton swinging that jack handle, and at the exact same moment, LeBay's eye gushes blood. He keels over, and suddenly, very suddenly, "Cut the shit, Dennis," I lectured. "Just cut the..." And then, somewhere deep in my mind, somewhere near the center, a voice whispered, "Come on, big guy. Let's cruise." And then fell still. The girl behind the counter popped her gum and said, "You're missing the end of the picture. Ending's the best part." "Yeah, thanks." I started back toward the door of the theater and then detoured to the drinking fountain. My throat was very dry. Before I'd finished getting my drink, the doors opened and people came streaming out. Beyond and above their bobbing heads, I could see the credit roll. Then Roseanne came out, looking around for me. She caught many appreciative glances and fielded them cleanly in that dreamy, composed way of hers. "Den-Den," she said, taking my arm. Being called Den-Den isn't the worst thing in the world. Having your eyes put out with a hot poker or having a leg amputated with a chainsaw is probably worse. But I've never really dug it all that much.
"Where were you? You missed the ending."
"Ending's the best part," I finished with her. "Sorry. I just had this call in nature. It came on very suddenly."
"I'll tell you all about it if you take me up to the embankment for a while," she said, pressing my arm against the soft side swell of her breast. "If you want to talk, that is."
"Did it have a happy ending?"
She smiled up at me, her eyes wide and sweet and a little dazed, as they always were. She held my arm even more tightly against her breast. "Very happy," she said. "I like happy endings. Don't you, Den-Den?"
"Love 'em," I said. I should maybe have been thinking about the promise of a breast, but instead, I found myself thinking about Arnie. That night I had a dream again. Only in this one Christine was old. No, not just old, she was ancient, a terrible hulk of a car, something you'd expect to see in a tarot deck. Instead of the Hanged Man, the Death Car, something you could almost believe was as old as the pyramids. The engine roared and missed and jetted filthy blue oil smoke. It wasn't empty. Roland D. LeBay was lolling behind the wheel. His eyes were open, but they were glazed and dead. Each time the engine revved and Christine's rust-eaten body vibrated, he flopped like a rag doll. His peeling skull nodded back and forth. Then the tires screamed their terrible scream. The Plymouth lunged out of the garage at me, and as it did, the rust melted away. The old, bleary glass clarified. The chrome winked with savage newness, and the old, balding tires suddenly bloomed into plump, new, wide ovals, each tread seemingly as deep as the Grand Canyon. It screamed at me, headlights glaring white circles of hate, and as I raised my hands in a stupid, useless, warding-off gesture, I thought, "God, it's unending fury." I woke up. I didn't scream. That night, I kept the scream in my throat. Just barely. I sat up in my bed, a cold puddle of moonlight caught in a lap full of sheet, and I thought, "Died suddenly." That night, I didn't get back to sleep so quickly. Chapter 11. The Funeral. Brad Jeffries, our road crew foreman, was in his mid-40s, balding, stocky, permanently sunburned. He liked to holler a lot, particularly when we were behind schedule, but was a decent enough man. I went to see him during our coffee break to find out if Arnie had asked for part or all of the afternoon off. "He asked for 2 hours so he could go to a burying," Brad said. He took off his steel-rimmed glasses and massaged the red spots they had left on the sides of his nose. "Now don't you ask. I'm losing you both at the end of the week anyway, and all the jerk-offs are staying." "Brad, I have to ask." "Why, who is this guy?" "Cunningham said he sold him a car, that's all."
Christ, I didn't think anyone went to a used car salesman's funeral except for his family. It wasn't a used car salesman. It was just a guy. Arnie's having some problems about this, Brad. I feel like I ought to go with him. Brad sighed. Okay, 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 okay. You can have 1 to 3, just like him, if you'll agree to work through your lunch hour and stay on till 6 Thursday night. Sure. Thanks, Brad. I'll punch you out just like regular, Brad said. And if anybody at Penn DOT in Pittsburgh finds out about this, my ass is gonna be grass. They won't. Gonna be sorry to lose you guys, he said. He picked up the paper and shook it out to the sports. Coming from Brad, that was high praise. It's been a good summer for us, too. I'm glad you feel that way, Dennis. Now get out of here and let me read the paper. I did. At 1 o'clock, I caught a ride up to the main construction shed on a grader. Arnie was inside, hanging up his yellow hard hat and putting on a clean shirt. He looked at me, startled. Dennis, what are you doing here? Getting ready to go to a funeral, I said. Same as you. No, he said immediately. And it was more that word than anything else. The Saturdays he was no longer there. The coolness of Michael and Regina over the phone. The way he had been when I called him from the movies. It made me realize how much he had shut me out of his life. And how it had happened in just the same way LeBay had died. Suddenly. Yes, I said. Arnie, I dream about the guy. You hear me talking to you? I dream about him. I'm going. We can go separately or together, but I'm going.
You weren't joking, were you?
Huh?
When you called me on the phone from that theater, you really didn't know he was dead?
Jesus Christ, you think I'd joke about something like that?
No,
he said, but not right away. He didn't say no until he'd thought it over carefully. He saw the possibility of all hands being turned against him now. Will Darnell had done that to him, and Buddy Repperton, and I suppose his mother and father, too. But it wasn't just them, or even principally them, because none of them was the first cause. It was the car.
You dream about him?
Yes. He stood there with his clean shirt in his hands, musing over that. The paper said Libertyville Heights Cemetery, I said, finally. You gonna take the bus or ride with me?
I'll ride with you.
Good deal. We stood on a hill above the graveside service, neither daring nor wanting to go down and join the handful of mourners. There were less than a dozen of them all told, half of them old guys in uniforms that looked old and carefully preserved. You could almost smell the mothballs. LeBay's casket was on runners over the grave. There was a flag on it. The preacher's words drifted up to us on a hot late August breeze. Man is like the grass which grows and then is cut down. Man is like a flower which blooms in the spring and fades in the summer. Man is in love and loves what passes. When the service ended, the flag was removed, and a man who looked to be in his 60s threw a handful of earth onto the coffin. Little particles trickled off and fell into the hole beneath. The obit had said he was survived by a brother and a sister. This had to be the brother. The resemblance wasn't overwhelming, but it was there. The sister evidently hadn't made it. There was no one but the boys down there around the hole in the ground. Two of the American Legion types folded the flag into a cocked hat, and one of them handed it to LeBay's brother. The preacher asked the Lord to bless them and keep them, to make his face shine upon them, to lift them up and give them peace. They started to drift away. I looked around for Arnie, and Arnie wasn't beside me anymore. He had gone a little distance away. He was standing under a tree. There were tears on his cheeks. You okay, Arnie? I asked. It occurred to me that I sure as hell hadn't seen any tears down there, and if Roland D. LeBay had known that Arnie Cunningham was going to be the only person to shed a tear for him at his small-time graveside ceremonies in one of western Pennsylvania's lesser-known boneyards, he might have knocked $50 off the price of his shitty car. After all, Arnie still would have been paying $150 more than it was worth. He skidded the heels of his hands up the sides of his face in a gesture that was nearly savage. Fine, he said hoarsely. Come on. Sure. I thought he meant it was time to go, but he didn't start back toward where I'd parked my duster. He started down the hill instead. I started to ask him where he was going and then shut my mouth. I knew well enough. He wanted to talk to LeBay's brother. The brother was standing with two of the Legionnaire types, talking quietly, the flag under his arm. He was dressed in the suit of a man who was approaching retirement on a questionable income. It was a blue pinstripe with a slightly shiny seat. His tie was wrinkled at the bottom, and his white shirt had a yellowish tinge at the collar. He glanced around at us.
"Pardon me," Arnie said, "but you're Mr. LeBay's brother, aren't you?"
"Yes, I am." He looked at Arnie questioningly, and, I thought, a little warily. Arnie put out his hand.
"My name is Arnold Cunningham. I knew your brother, slightly. I bought a car from him a short while ago."
When Arnie put his hand out, LeBay had automatically reached for it. With American men, the only gesture which may be more ingrained than the handshake response is checking your fly to make sure it's zipped after you come out of a public restroom. But when Arnie went on to say that he had bought a car from LeBay, the hand hesitated on its course. For a moment, I thought the man was not going to shake after all, that he would pull back and just leave Arnie's hand floating out there in the ozone. But he didn't do that. At least, not quite. He gave Arnie's hand a single token squeeze and then dropped it.
"Christine," he said in a dry voice.
Yes, the family resemblance was there, in the way the brow shelved over the eyes, the set of the jaw, the light blue eyes. But this man's face was softer, almost kind. I did not think he was ever going to have the lean and vulpine aspects that had been Roland D. LeBay's.
"The last note I got from Raleigh said he'd sold her."
Good Christ. He was using that damned female pronoun, too. And Raleigh. It was hard to imagine LeBay, with his peeling skull and his pestiferous back brace, as anyone's Raleigh. But his brother had spoken the nickname in that same dry voice. There was no love in that voice, at least none that I could hear. LeBay went on.
"My brother didn't write often, but he had a tendency to gloat, Mr. Cunningham. I wish there was a gentler word for it, but I don't believe there is. In his note, Raleigh spoke of you as a sucker, and said he had given you what he called a royal screwing."
My mouth dropped open. I turned to Arnie, half expecting another outburst of rage. But his face hadn't changed at all.
"A royal screwing," he said mildly, "is always in the eye of the beholder. Don't you think so, Mr. LeBay?"
LeBay laughed, a little reluctantly, I thought.
"This is my friend. He was with me the day I bought the car."
I was introduced and shook George LeBay's hand. The soldiers had drifted away. The three of us, LeBay, Arnie, and I, were left eyeing one another uncomfortably. LeBay shifted his brother's flag from one hand to the other.
"Can I do something for you, Mr. Cunningham?"
LeBay asked at last. Arnie cleared his throat.
"I was wondering about the garage," he said finally. "You see, I'm working on the car, trying to get her street legal again. My folks don't want it at my house, and I was wondering..."
"No."
"If maybe I could rent the garage."
"No, out of the question. It's really..." "I'd pay you $20 a week," Arnie said.
"$25 if you wanted."
I winced. He was like a kid who has stumbled into quicksand and decides to cheer himself up by eating a few arsenic-laced brownies. "Impossible." LeBay was looking more and more distressed.
"Just the garage," Arnie said, his calm starting to crack. "Just the garage where it originally was."
"It can't be done," LeBay said. "I listed the house with Century 21, Libertyville Realty, and Pittsburgh Homes just this morning. They'll be showing the house."
"Yes, sure, in time, but until..."
"And it wouldn't do to have you tinkering around. You see, don't you?" He bent toward Arnie a little. "Please don't misunderstand me. I have nothing against teenagers in general. If I did, I'd probably be in a lunatic asylum now because I've taught high school in Paradise Falls, Ohio for almost 40 years. And you seem to be a very intelligent, well-spoken example of the genus adolescent. But all I want to do here in Libertyville is sell the house and split whatever proceeds there may be with my sister in Denver. I want to be shot of the house, Mr. Cunningham, and I want to be shot of my brother's life.
I see, Arnie said. Wouldn't it make any difference if I promised to look after the place? Mow the grass, repaint the trim, make little repairs? I can be handy that way.
He really is good at stuff like that, I chipped in. It wouldn't hurt, I thought, for Arnie to remember later that I had been on his side, even if I wasn't. I've already hired a fella to keep an eye on the place and do a little maintenance, he said. It sounded plausible, but I knew suddenly and surely that it was a lie. And I think Arnie knew it, too.
All right. I'm sorry about your brother. He seemed like a very strong-willed man.
As he said it, I found myself remembering turning around and seeing LeBay with large, greasy tears on his cheeks.
Well, that's that. I'm shut of her, sonny.
Strong-willed?
LeBay smiled cynically.
Oh, yes. He was a strong-willed son of a bitch.
He appeared not to notice Arnie's shocked expression.
Excuse me, gentlemen. I'm afraid the sun has upset my stomach a little.
He started to walk away. We stood not far from the grave and watched him go. All at once he stopped, and Arnie's face brightened. He thought LeBay had suddenly changed his mind. For a moment, LeBay just stood there on the grass, his head bent in the posture of a man thinking hard. Then he turned back to us.
My advice to you is to forget the car, he said to Arnie. Sell her. If no one will buy her whole, sell her for parts. If no one will buy her for parts, junk her. Do it quickly and completely. Do it the way you would quit a bad habit. I think you will be happier.
He stood there, looking at Arnie, waiting for Arnie to say something, but Arnie made no reply. He only held LeBay's gaze with his own. His eyes had gone that peculiar, slaty color they got when his mind was made up and his feet were planted. LeBay read the look and nodded. He looked unhappy and a little ill.
Gentlemen, good day.
Arnie sighed.
I guess that's that.
He eyed LeBay's retreating back with some resentment.
Yeah, I said, hoping I sounded more unhappy than I felt. It was the dream. I didn't like the idea of Christine back in that garage. It was too much like my dream.
We started back toward my car, neither of us speaking. LeBay nagged at me. Both LeBays nagged at me. I came to a sudden, impulsive decision. God only knows how much different things might have been if I hadn't followed the impulse.
Hey, man, I said. I gotta take a whiz. Give me a minute or two, okay?
Sure, he said, hardly looking up. He walked on, hands in his pockets and eyes on the ground. I walked off to the left, where a small discreet sign and an even smaller arrow pointed the way toward the restrooms. But when I was over the first rise and out of Arnie's view, I cut to the right and started to sprint toward the parking lot. I caught George LeBay slowly folding himself behind the wheel of an extremely tiny Chevette with a Hertz sticker on the windshield.
Mr. LeBay, I puffed. Mr. LeBay?
He looked up curiously.
Pardon me, I said. Sorry to bother you again.
That's all right, he said. But I'm afraid what I said to your friend still stands. I can't let him garage the car there.
Good, I said.
His bushy eyebrows went up.
The car, I said. That Fury. I don't like it.
He went on looking at me, not talking.
I don't think it's been good for him. Maybe part of it's being, I don't know.
Jealous? He asked me quietly. Time he used to spend with you, he now spends with her?
Well, yeah, right, I said. He's been my friend for a long time, but I don't think that's all of it.
No?
No.
I looked around to see if Arnie was in sight, and while I wasn't looking at him, I was finally able to come out with it.
Why did you tell him to junk it and forget it?
Why did you say it was like a bad habit? He said nothing, and I was afraid he had nothing to say, at least not to me. And then, almost too softly to hear, he asked,
Son, are you sure this is your business?
I don't know. Suddenly it seemed very important to meet his eyes. But I care about Arnie, you know? I don't want to see him get hurt. His car has already gotten him in trouble. I don't want to see it get any worse.
Come by my motel this evening. It's just off the Western Avenue exit from 376. Can you find that?
I hot-patched the sides of the ramp, I said, and held out my hands. Still got the blisters.
I smiled, but he didn't smile back. Rainbow Motel. There are two at the foot of that exit. Mine is the cheap one.
Thanks, I said awkwardly. Listen, really,
It may not be your business, or mine, or anyone's, LeBay said in his soft, schoolteacherish voice, so different from, but somehow so eerily similar to, his late brother's wild croak.
And that's about the finest smell in the world, except maybe for pussy.
But I can tell you this much right now. My brother was not a good man. I believe the only thing he ever truly loved in his whole life was that Plymouth Fury your friend has purchased. So the business may be between them and them alone, no matter what you tell me or I tell you.
He smiled at me. It wasn't a pleasant smile, and in that instant I seemed to see Roland D. LeBay looking out through his eyes. And I shivered.
Son, you're probably too young to look for wisdom in anyone's words but your own, but I'll tell you this. Love is the enemy.
He nodded at me slowly.
Yes. The poets continually and sometimes willfully mistake love. Love is the old slaughterer. Love is not blind. Love is a cannibal with extremely acute vision. Love is insectile. It is always hungry.
What does it eat? I asked, not aware I was going to ask anything at all. Every part of me but my mouth thought the entire conversation insane.
Friendship, George LeBay said. It eats friendship. If I were you, Dennis, I would now prepare for the worst.
He closed the door of the Chevette with a soft chuck and started up its sewing machine engine. He drove away, leaving me to stand there on the edge of the blacktop. I suddenly remembered that Arnie should see me coming from the direction of the comfort stations, so I headed that way as fast as I could. As I went, it occurred to me that the gravediggers, or sextons, or eternal engineers, or whatever they were calling themselves these days, would now be lowering LeBay's coffin into the earth. The dirt George LeBay had thrown at the end of the ceremony would be splattered across the top, like a conquering hand. I tried to dismiss the image, but another image, even worse, came in its place. Roland D. LeBay inside the silk-lined casket, dressed in his best suit and his best underwear, sans smelly, yellowing back brace, of course. LeBay was in the ground. LeBay was in his coffin, his hands crossed on his chest. And why was I so sure that a large, shit-eating grin was on his face?
Chapter 12. Some Family History.
The Rainbow Motel was pretty bad, all right. It was one level high, the parking lot paving was cracked, two of the letters in the neon sign were out. It was exactly the sort of place you'd expect to find an elderly English teacher. I know how depressing that sounds, but it's true. And tomorrow he would turn in his Hertz car at the airport and fly home to Paradise Falls, Ohio. The Rainbow Motel looked like a geriatric ward. There were old parties sitting outside their rooms in the lawn chairs the management supplied for that purpose, their bony knees crossed, their white socks pulled up over their hairy shins. The men all looked like aging alpinists, skinny and tough. Most of the women were blooming with the soft fat of post-50 and no hope. Since then I've noticed that there are motels which seem filled up with nothing but people over 50. It's like they hear about these places on some oldies but goodies hotline. Bring your hysterectomy and enlarged prostate to the not-so-scenic Rainbow Motel. No cable TV, but we do have magic fingers, just a quarter a shot. I saw no young people outside the units, and off to one side, the rusty playground equipment stood empty, the swings casting long, still shadows on the ground. Overhead, a neon rainbow arced over the sign. It buzzed like a swarm of flies caught in a bottle. LeBay was sitting outside Unit 14 with a glass in his hand. I went over and shook hands with him. "Would you like a soft drink?" he asked. "There's a machine in the office that dispenses them." "No, thanks," I said. I got one of the lawn chairs from in front of an empty unit and sat down beside him. "Then let me tell you what I can," he said in his soft, cultured voice. "I'm 11 years younger than Raleigh, and I'm still a man who is learning to be old." I shifted awkwardly in my chair and said nothing. "There were four of us," he said. "Raleigh was the oldest, I the youngest. Our brother Drew died in France in 1944. He and Raleigh were both career army. We grew up here in Libertyville. Only Libertyville was much, much smaller then. You know, only a village. Small enough to have the ins and the outs. We were the outs. Poor folks. Shiftless. Wrong side of the tracks. Pick your cliché." He chuckled softly in the dusk and poured more 7-Up into his glass. "I really remember only one constant thing about Raleigh's childhood. After all, he was in the 5th grade when I was born. But I remember that one thing very well."
"What was it?"
"His anger," LeBay said. "Raleigh was always angry. He was angry that he had to go to school and cast off clothes. He was angry that our father was a drunkard who could not hold a steady job in any of the steel mills. He was angry that our mother could not make our father stop drinking. He was angry at the 3 smaller children, Drew, Marcia, and myself, who made the poverty insurmountable." He held out his arm to me and pushed up the sleeve of his shirt to show me the withered, corded tendons of his old man's arm, which lay just below the surface of the shiny, stretched skin. A scar skidded from his elbow toward his wrist, where it finally petered out. "That was a present from Raleigh," he said. "I got it when I was 3 and he was 14. I was playing with a few painted blocks of wood that were supposed to be cars and trucks on the front walk when he slammed out on his way to school. I was in his way, I suppose. He pushed me, went on to the sidewalk, and then he came back and threw me. I landed with my arm stuck on one of the pickets of the fence that went around the bunch of weeds and sunflowers that my mother insisted on calling the garden. I bled enough to scare all of them into tears, all of them except Raleigh, who just kept shouting, 'You stay out of my way from now on, you goddamn snot-nose. Stay out of my way, you hear?'" I looked at the old scar, fascinated, realizing that it looked like a skid because that small, chubby 3-year-old's arm had grown over the course of years into the skinny, shiny old man's arm I was now looking at. A wound that had been an ugly gouge spilling blood everywhere in the year 1921 had slowly elongated into this silvery progression of marks like ladder rungs. The wound had closed, but the scar had spread. A terrible, hopeless shudder twisted through me. I thought of Arnie slamming his fist down on the dashboard of my car, Arnie crying hoarsely that he would make them eat it, eat it, eat it. George LeBay was looking at me. I don't know what he saw on my face, but he slowly rolled his sleeve back down, and when he buttoned it securely over that scar, it was as if he had drawn the curtain on an almost unbearable past. He sipped more 7-Up. "My father came home that evening. He had been on one of the toots that he called hunting up a job, and when he heard what Raleigh had done, he wailed the tar out of him. But Raleigh would not recant. He cried, but he would not recant." LeBay smiled a little. At the end, my mother was terrified, screaming for my father to stop before he killed him. The tears were rolling down Raleigh's face, and still he would not recant. "He was in my way," Raleigh said through his tears. "And if he gets in my way again, I'll do it again, and you can't stop me, you damned old tosspot." Then my father struck him in the face and made his nose bleed, and Raleigh fell on the floor with the blood squirting through his fingers. My mother was screaming, Marcia was crying, Drew was cringing in one corner, and I was bawling my head off, holding my bandaged arm. And Raleigh went right on saying, "I do it again, you tosspot, tosspot, damned old tosspot."
Above us, the stars had begun to come out. An old woman left a unit down the way, took a battered suitcase out of a Ford, and carried it back into her unit. Somewhere, a radio was playing. It was not tuned to the rock sounds of FM 104.
"His unending fury is what I remember best," LeBay repeated softly. "At school, he fought with anyone who made fun of his clothes or the way his hair was cut. He would fight anyone he even suspected of making fun. He was suspended again and again. Finally, he left and joined the army." It wasn't a good time to be in the army, the 20s. There was no dignity, no promotion, no flying flags and banners. There was no nobility. He went from base to base, first in the South and then in the Southwest. We got a letter every 3 months or so. He was still angry. He was angry at what he called the shitters. Everything was the fault of the shitters. The shitters wouldn't give him the promotion he deserved. The shitters had canceled a furlough. The shitters couldn't find their own behinds with both hands and a flashlight. On at least two occasions, the shitters put him in the stockade. The army held on to him because he was an excellent mechanic. He could keep the old and decrepit vehicles, which were all Congress would allow the army, in some sort of running condition. Uneasily, I found myself thinking of Arnie again, Arnie, who was so clever with his hands. LeBay leaned forward. "But that talent was just another wellspring for his anger, young man. And it was an anger that never ended until he bought that car that your friend now owns."
"What do you mean?"
LeBay chuckled dryly.
"He fixed Army convoy trucks, Army staff cars, Army weapons supply vehicles. He fixed bulldozers and kept staff cars running with spit and baling wire. And once, when a visiting congressman came to visit Fort Arnold in West Texas and had car trouble, he was ordered by his commanding officer, who was desperate to make a good impression, to fix the congressman's prized Bentley. Oh, yes, we got a 4-page letter for that particular shitter. A 4-page rant of Raleigh's anger and vitriol. It was a wonder the words didn't smoke on the page. All those vehicles. But Raleigh never owned a car himself until after World War II. Even then, the only thing he was able to afford was an old Chevrolet that ran poorly and was eaten up with rust. In the 20s and 30s, there was never money enough, and during the war years, he was too busy trying to stay alive. He was in the motor pool for all those years, and he fixed thousands of vehicles for the shitters and never had one that was all his. It was Libertyville all over again. Even the old Chevrolet couldn't assuage that. Or the old Hudson Hornet he bought used the year after he got married."
"Married?"
"Didn't tell you that, did he?" LeBay said. "He would have been happy to go on and on about his army experiences, his war experiences, and his endless confrontations with the shitters, for as long as you and your friend could listen without falling asleep. And him with his hand in your pocket, feeling for your wallet the whole time. But he wouldn't have bothered to tell you about Veronica or Rita."
"Who were they?"
"Veronica was his wife," LeBay said. "They were married in 1951, shortly before Raleigh went to Korea. He could have stayed stateside, you know. He was married, his wife was pregnant, he himself was approaching middle age. But he chose to go." LeBay looked reflectively at the dead playground equipment. "It was bigamy, you know. By 1951, he was 44, and he was married already. He was married to the army, and to the shitters." He fell silent again. His silence had a morbid quality.
"Are you all right?"
I asked finally. "Yes," he said. "Just thinking. Thinking ill of the dead." He looked at me calmly, except for his eyes. They were dark and wounded. "You know, all of this hurts me, young man. What did you say your name was? I don't want to sit here and sing these old sad songs to someone I can't call by his first name. Was it Donald?"
"Dennis," I said.
"Look, Mr. LeBay..." "It hurts more than I would have suspected," he went on. "But now that it's begun, let's finish it, shall we? I only met Veronica twice, She was from West Virginia, near Wheeling. She was what we then called shirt-tail Southern, and she was not terribly bright. Raleigh was able to dominate her and take her for granted, which was what he seemed to want. But she loved him, I think, at least until the rotten business with Rita. As for Raleigh, I don't think he really married a woman at all. He married a kind of Wailing Wall. The letters that he sent us, well, you must remember that he left school very early. The letters, illiterate as they were, represented a tremendous effort for my brother. They were his suspension bridge, his novel, his symphony, his great effort. I don't think he wrote them to get rid of the poison in his heart. I think he wrote them to spread it around. Once he had Veronica, the letters stopped. He had his set of eternal ears, and he didn't have to bother with us anymore. I suppose he wrote letters to her during the 2 years he was in Korea. I only got one during that period, and I believe Marcia got two. There was no pleasure over the birth of his daughter in early 1952, only a surly complaint that there was another mouth to feed at home, and the shitters took a little more out of him. "Did he never advance in rank?" I asked. The year before, I had seen part of a long TV show, one of those novels for television called Once an Eagle. I had seen the paperback book in the drugstore the next day and had picked it up, hoping for a good war story. As it turned out, I got both war and peace, and some new ideas about the armed services. One of them was that the old promotion train really gets rolling along in times of war. It was hard for me to understand how LeBay could have gone into the service in the early 20s, slogged through 2 wars, and still have been running junk when Ike became president. LeBay laughed. He was like Pruitt in From Here to Eternity. He would advance, and then he would be busted back down for something. Insubordination, or impertinence, or drunkenness. I told you he had spent time in the stockade. One of those times was for pissing in the punch bowl at the officers' club at Fort Dix before a party. He only did 10 days for that offense because I believe they must have looked into their own hearts and believed it was nothing more than a drunken joke, such as some of the officers themselves had probably played as fraternity boys. They didn't, they couldn't have any idea of the hate and deadly loathing that lay behind that gesture. But I imagine that by then, Veronica could have told them. I glanced at my watch. It was 9:15. LeBay had been talking for nearly an hour. My brother came home from Korea in 1953 to meet his daughter for the first time. I understand he looked her over for a minute or two, then handed her back to his wife, and went out to tinker on his old Chevrolet for the rest of the day. Getting bored, Dennis? No, I said truthfully. All through those years, the one thing that Raleigh really wanted was a brand new car. Not a Cadillac or a Lincoln. He didn't want to join the upper class, the officers, the shitters. He wanted a new Plymouth, or maybe a Ford or a Dodge. Veronica wrote now and then, and she said that they spent most of their Sundays going around to car dealerships, wherever Raleigh was currently stationed. She and the baby would sit in the old Hornet Raleigh had then, and Veronica would read little storybooks to Rita, while Raleigh walked around dusty lot after dusty lot with salesman after salesman, talking about compression and horsepower and Hemi heads and gear ratios. I think sometimes of the little girl growing up to the background sound of those plastic pennants whipping in the hot wind of 6 army tank towns, and I don't know whether to laugh or cry. My thoughts turned back to Arnie again. Was he obsessed, would you say? Yes. I would say he was obsessed. He began to give Veronica money to put away. Other than his failure to get promoted past Master Sergeant at any point in his career, my brother had a problem with drink. He wasn't an alcoholic, but he went on periodic binges every 6 or 8 months. What money he had would be gone when the binge was over. He was never sure where he spent it. Veronica was supposed to put a stop to that. It was one of the things he married her for. When the binges started, Raleigh would come to her for the money. He threatened her with a knife once, held it to her throat. I got this from my sister, who sometimes talked to Veronica on the telephone. Veronica would not give him the money, which at that time, in 1955, totaled about $800. "Remember the car, honey," she told him, with the point of his knife on her throat. "You'll never get that new car if and you booze the money away." "She must have loved him," I said. "Well, maybe she did. But please don't make the romantic assumption that her love changed Raleigh in any way. Water can wear away stone, but only over hundreds of years. People are mortal." He seemed to debate saying something else along that line and then to decide against it. The lapse struck me as peculiar. "But he never put a mark on either of them," he said. "And you must remember that he was drunk on the occasion when he held the knife to her throat. There is a great outcry about drugs in the schools now, and I don't oppose that outcry because I think it's obscene to think of children 15 and 16 years old reeling around full of dope. But I still believe alcohol is the most vulgar, dangerous drug ever invented. And it is legal." When my brother finally left the army in 1957, Veronica had put away a little over $1,200. Adding to it was a substantial disability pension for his back injury. He fought the shitters for it and won, he said. So the money was finally there. They got the house you and your friend visited, but before the house was even considered, of course, the car came. The car was always paramount. The visits to the car dealerships reached a fever pitch, and at last he settled upon Christine. I got a long letter about her. She was a 1958 Fury Sport Coupe, and he gave me all the facts and figures in his letter. I don't remember them, but I bet your friend could cite her vital statistics chapter and verse. "Her measurements," I said. LeBay smiled humorlessly. "Her measurements, yes. I do remember that he wrote her sticker price was just a tad under 3,000, but he Jewed 'em down, as he put it, to 2,100 with the trade-in. He ordered her, paid 10% down, and when she came in, he paid the balance in cash. $10 and $20 bills. The next year, Rita, who was then 6, choked to death. I jumped in my chair and almost knocked it over. His soft, teacherish voice had a lulling quality, and I was tired. I had been half asleep. That last had been like a dash of cold water in my face. "Yes, that's right," he said to my questioning, startled glance. They had been out motorvating for the day. That was what replaced the car hunting expeditions. Motorvating, that was his word for it. He got that from one of those rock and roll songs he was always listening to. Every Sunday the three of them would go out motorvating. There were litter bags in the front and the back. The little girl was forbidden to drop anything on the floor. She was forbidden to make any messes. She knew that lesson well. He fell into that peculiar thinking silence again, and then came back on a new tack. Raleigh kept the ashtrays clean. Always. He was a heavy smoker, but he'd poke his cigarette out the wing window instead of tapping it into the ashtray. And when he was done with the cigarette, he'd snuff it and toss it out the window. If he had someone with him who did use the ashtray, he'd dump the ashtray and then wipe it out with a paper towel when the drive was over. He washed her twice a week and simonized her twice a year. He serviced her himself, buying time at a local garage. I wondered if it had been Darnell's. On that particular Sunday, they stopped at a roadside stand for hamburgers on the way home. There were no McDonald's in those days, you know, just roadside stands. And what happened was simple enough, I suppose. That silence again, as if he wondered just how much he should tell me, or how to separate what he knew from his speculations. "She choked to death on a piece of meat," he said finally. "When she started to gag and put her hands to her throat, Raleigh pulled over, dragged her out of the car, and thudded her on the back, trying to bring it up. Of course, now they have a method, the Heimlich maneuver, that works rather well in situations like that. A young girl, a student teacher actually, saved a boy who was choking in the cafeteria at my school just last year by employing the Heimlich maneuver. But in those days, my niece died by the side of the road. I imagine it was a filthy, frightening way to die. His voice had resumed that sleepy schoolroom cadence, but I no longer felt sleepy. Not at all. He tried to save her, I believe that, and I try to believe that it was only ill luck that she died. He had been in a ruthless business for a long time, and I don't believe he loved his daughter very deeply, if at all. But sometimes, in mortal matters, a lack of love can be a saving grace. Sometimes ruthlessness is what is required. But not this time, I said. In the end, he turned her over and held her by her ankles. He punched her in the belly, hoping to make her vomit. I believe he would have tried to do a tracheotomy on her with his pocket knife if he had even the slightest idea of how to go about it. But of course, he did not. She died. Marcia and her husband and family came to the funeral. So did I. It was our last family reunion. I remember thinking, he will have traded the car, of course. In an odd way, I was a little disappointed. It had figured so largely in Veronica's letters, and the few which Raleigh wrote, that I felt it was almost a member of their family. But he hadn't. They pulled up to the Libertyville Methodist Church in it, and it was polished, and shining, and hateful. It was hateful. He turned to look at me. Do you believe that, Dennis? I had to swallow before I could answer. Yes, I said. I believe it. LeBay nodded grimly. Veronica was sitting in the passenger seat like a wax dummy. Whatever she had been, whatever there was inside her, was gone. Raleigh had had the car. She had had the daughter. She didn't just grieve, she died. I sat there and tried to imagine it, tried to imagine what I would have done if it had been me. My daughter starts to choke and strangle in the back seat of my car and then dies by the side of the road. Would I trade the car away? Why, it wasn't the car that killed her. It was whatever she strangled on, the bit of hamburger and bun that had blocked her windpipe. So why trade the car? Other than the small fact that I wouldn't even be able to look at it. Wouldn't even be able to think of it without horror and sorrow. Would I trade it? Man, does a bear shit in the woods. Did you ask him about it? I asked him, all right. Marcia was with me. It was after the service. Veronica's brother had come up from Glory, West Virginia, and he took her back to the house after the graveside ceremony. She was in a kind of walking swoon anyway. We got him alone, Marcia and I. That was the real reunion. I asked him if he intended to trade the car. It was parked directly behind the hearse that had brought his daughter to the cemetery. The same cemetery where Raleigh himself was buried today, you know. It was red and white. Chrysler never offered the 1958 Plymouth Fury in those colors. Raleigh had gotten it custom painted. We were standing about 50 feet away from it, and I had the strangest feeling, the strangest urge, to move yet farther away, as if it could hear us. What did you say? I asked him if he was going to trade the car. That hard, mulish look came into his face, that look I remembered so well from my early childhood. It was the look that had been on his face when he threw me onto the picket fence, the look that was on his face when he kept calling my father a tosspot, even after my father made his nose bleed. He said, I'd be crazy to trade her, George. She's only a year old, and she's only got 11,000 miles on her. You know you never get your money out of a trade until a car's 3 years old. I said, if this is a matter of money to you, Raleigh, someone stole what was left of your heart and replaced it with a piece of stone. Do you want your wife looking at it every day, riding in it? Good God, man! That look never changed. Not until he looked at the car, sitting there in the sunlight, sitting there behind the hearse. That was the only time his face softened. I remember wondering if he'd ever looked at Rita that way. I don't suppose he ever did. I don't think it was in him. He fell silent for a moment, and then went on. Marcia told him all the same things. She was always afraid of Raleigh, but that day she was more mad than afraid. She had gotten Veronica's letters, remember, and she knew how much Veronica loved her little girl. She told him that when someone dies, you burn the mattress they slept on, you give their clothes to the Salvation Army, whatever, you put finish to the life any way you can so that the living can get on with their business. She told him that his wife was never going to be able to get on with her business as long as the car where her daughter died was still in the garage. Raleigh asked her in that ugly, sarcastic way he had if she wanted him to douse his car with gasoline and touch a match to her just because his daughter had choked to death. My sister started to cry and told him she thought that was a fine idea. Finally, I took her by the arm and led her away. There was no talking to Raleigh then or ever. The car was his, and he could talk on and on about keeping a car 3 years before you trade it, and he could talk about mileage until he was blue in the face, but the simple fact was, he was going to keep her because he wanted to keep her. Marcia and her family went back to Denver on a Greyhound, and so far as I know, she never saw Raleigh again, or even wrote him a note. She didn't come to Veronica's funeral. His wife. First the kid and then the wife. I knew somehow that it had been just like that. Bang, bang. A kind of numbness crept up my legs to the pit of my stomach. She died 6 months later, in January of 1959. But nothing to do with the car, I said. Nothing to do with the car, right? It had everything to do with the car, he said softly. I don't want to hear it, I thought. But of course, I would hear it. Because my friend owned that car now. And because it had become something that had grown out of all proportion to what it should have been in his life. After Rita died, Veronica went into a depression. She simply never came out of it. She had made some friends in Libertyville, and they tried to help her. Help her find her way again, I guess one would say. But she was not able to find her way. Not at all. Otherwise, things were fine. For the first time in my brother's life, there was plenty of money. He had his army pension, his disability pension, and he had gotten a job as a night watchman at the tire factory over on the west side of town. I drove over there after the funeral, but it's gone. It went broke 12 years ago, I said. I was just a kid. There's a Chinese fast food place there now. They were paying off the mortgage at the rate of 2 payments a month, and, of course, they had no little girl to take care of any longer. But for Veronica, there was never any light or impulse toward recovery. She went about committing suicide quite cold-bloodedly, from all that I've been able to find out. If there were textbooks for aspiring suicides, her own might be included as an example to emulate. She went down to the Western Auto Store here in town, the same one where I got my first bicycle many, many years ago, and bought 20 feet of rubber hose. She fitted one end over Christine's exhaust pipe and put the other end in one of the back windows. She had never gotten a driver's license, but she knew how to start a car. That was really all she needed to know. I pursed my lips, wet them with my tongue, and heard my voice little more than a rusty croak. I think I'll get that soda now. Perhaps you'd be good enough to get me another, he said. It will keep me awake, they always do. But I suspect I'd be awake most of tonight anyway. I suspect that I would be, too. I went to get the sodas in the motel office, and on my way back I stopped halfway across the parking lot. He was only a deeper shadow in front of his motel unit, his white socks glimmering like small ghosts. I thought, maybe the car is cursed. Maybe that's what it is.
It sounds like a ghost story, all right. There's a signpost up ahead. Next stop, the Twilight Zone.
But that was ridiculous.
Wasn't it?
Of course it was. I went on walking again. Cars didn't carry curses any more than people carried them. That was horror movie stuff, sort of amusing for a Saturday night at the drive-in, but very, very far from the day-to-day facts that make up reality. I gave him